Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN during this end of fiscal year membership campaign. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We are less than 2 weeks away from the 20 of the Democratic presidential candidates who are going to be on a stage here at the Arch Center for their debates. We still don't know what the topics are going to be, but being South Florida, you would imagine housing, higher wages, climate risk, immigration. I mean, these are some of the ones that should pop up. WLRN Sundial is hosting two town hall nights on the 24th and 25th to discuss immigration and climate risk. You can go to WLRN.org to get your seat today. They are limited. The events begin at 7 o'clock. But we're joined now by former Republican representative from Florida's 26th District, Carlos Curbelo. He's with us today in studio. Congressman Curbelo, thank you so much for being with us.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You know, I mean, 2 weeks away, 20 candidates on the stage over two nights. And again, there's 23 candidates altogether. Let's just recall that in 2016, Hillary Clinton did win Miami-Dade. Last year, there was a surge of Democratic wins. But 2020, how do you see that playing out?
So Florida's going to be probably a deciding state, as it usually is. It's definitely up for grabs. We see the Democrats choosing South Florida for to host the first series of debates, I guess we should call it. And then, of course, the president is relaunching his campaign or launching his reelection campaign in Orlando. So Florida, as always, is the place to be. We're going to get a lot of attention. You're going to see a lot of ads on television. And it is quite possible that this state determines whether the president gets another 4 years or whether we have a new president in January of 2021.
So you look at the candidates that are stepping up. I'm asking a Republican to tell me what he thinks. What do all of those candidates have to do to make an impression on Miami-Dade County voters?
So I think the most dangerous kind of candidate for President Trump is a candidate that can build a coalition. So the president was able to disrupt the traditional Democratic coalition in 2016, taking a lot of union votes from states in the Midwest, obviously winning a state like Florida, a lot of immigrants, Hispanic immigrants that have been trending Democratic did vote for the president. So again, that's why I think for Democrats, the most attractive candidate would be one that can build a broad coalition, someone who could reestablish what they've traditionally called the Democratic blue wall in the Midwest. So I think Joe Biden, even though a lot of people say he's older and Democrats are looking for someone newer and fresher and more interesting, I think he'd be a very strong candidate against the president. And then I've also been intrigued by candidates like Pete Buttigieg, Beto O'Rourke, Pete Buttigieg these days, because those are the types of candidates that can become movement candidates. So think of President Obama and how when he first came onto the scene, people didn't take him seriously. They say he wasn't experienced enough, yet he was new, interesting, said something interesting about the country and motivated a lot of people to the polls that wouldn't typically show up. I think Buttigieg has that potential.
You know, we talk about what sort of topics they should discuss. And again, this coming back to what's important to people in South Florida. And as I mentioned, we're going to host town halls on climate risk and immigration as two of the ones we think are most important. But let me start with this, you know, for one of the issues, which is climate risk. You were going to testify at a House Ways and Means Committee on a proposal. The invitation was rescinded. You still showed up, though. What were you going to testify that day?
So the Democratic chairman of the committee, Richard Neal, invited me to testify because he thought, you know, if we want to solve these major challenges, and obviously climate change is the biggest, in my view, we're going to need bipartisan action. The way our government is designed, it's very difficult for either party to do anything on its own, right? So Chairman Neal invites me to testify, and then some of the more liberal Democrats in the House Democratic Caucus get very angry and question why a Democratic chairman would invite former Republican member of Congress to testify. And I actually thought Chairman Neal had a very good idea, because it would have been very powerful for a Republican to sit at the witness table and make the case to Republicans and Democrats that they should work together to solve this issue. I published my testimony, and essentially what I said was that this is a real challenge that requires bipartisan action, and that I think the most efficient and effective way of reducing carbon pollution, carbon emissions, is to tax carbon emissions.
You were going to testify
a price on carbon.
You were going to testify on a carbon tax.
That's right.
Why has it been so difficult? And you have been attacked by some in your party on the issue of climate risk, climate change. And it's to say, I've seen Republicans starting to turn on this, but why has your party been so reluctant to grab onto this?
Well, what I tried to do while I was in Congress, and I continue to try to do today, is to undo the polarization on this issue. I think back, and this is not an excuse for Republicans, but I think it certainly helps us understand why Republicans got to the point we're at now. I actually think we bottomed out 2014, 2015. After the 2000 election, which at the time had been the most divisive in a generation, I'd say 2016 probably beat that 2000 election. But, you know, Bush beat Al Gore. Al Gore was ridiculed and earned the disdain of a lot of people on the American right. And then he became the face of American environmentalism. And a lot of Republicans just assumed
because it was Al Gore, if
this is his cause, then we must oppose it. Of course, that doesn't make sense, but that's how it all started. And the politics started polarizing more and more every year. And in 2014-15, when I got to Congress, and I started asking around because I wanted to recruit other Republicans to help address this, no one wanted to talk about it. Few people even wanted to utter the words climate change. So we started the Climate Solutions Caucus and got a bipartisan dialogue going. I did that with Ted Deutch, and we made a lot of progress. And today, Republicans are in a much better place than they were 4 or 5 years
ago. Just real quickly, though, I wanted your take on the Democrats' Green New Deal, because this has also been very divisive, but how do you think this is going to play out? How should it play out?
First, it has made a contribution already. Why? Because it has elevated the issue, and it has people talking about climate change and about potential solutions. Now, having said that, the Green New Deal is not a solution to reduce carbon pollution. It isn't even a bill. It's an idea. It's a concept. It's an aspirational document. It uses the climate crisis to radically transform our economy and to move us closer to an economy where the government is the protagonist. And that's something that I'm strongly opposed to. In what would have been my testimony, I also criticize the Green New Deal, although I do recognize that at the very least it has sparked a national conversation and has elevated the issue of climate change.
I want to point out, too, by the way, real quickly, is that you did have an op-ed piece, I believe, in the Tampa Bay Times not too long ago about
yesterday.
Carbon tax.
That's right.
So just to point out, if you do want to check that out. Again, talking with Carlos Curbelo, former U.S. representative for Florida's 26th Congressional District, and we're going to take a quick break here, come back, we're going to talk about immigration and ask him about his future. What is in his future if he's going to be running for any office anytime soon? But as we take this break, I just want to remind you that, you know, this is a special membership campaign that we're doing this week because, you know, again, public radio depends on you. You know, you are the public in public radio. And so we want to say thank you, first of all, for your support. But if you haven't made that call, take a moment just for a couple of minutes. You can go online or call and pledge your support right now for programs like this one. All right, well, welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for your support. I appreciate it. I want to jump back into our conversation with former Congressman Carlos Curbelo, again, of Florida's 26th Congressional District, and we are approaching the Democratic debates coming up here in Miami. The other issue, Congressman, I wanted to talk to you about was immigration. This, again, one of the two town halls that we're going to host. And I wanted to ask about, because this is going to be one of the issues that will be discussed throughout the 2020 campaign. It is the facilities where we are now putting unaccompanied children. We have the Homestead temporary shelter for unaccompanied children right now. You visited this place last year.
That's right.
And there was a quote from the Miami Herald, and you had said the miners in this facility are being treated with great care and compassion. Could you tell us what you saw that day?
So I visited two facilities, one in Homestead and one in Palmetto Bay, which cares for very small children, so children under the age of five. In the case of the Palmetto Bay shelter that's run by the Catholic Church, my wife and I visited. The children received a very high level of care. As a matter of fact, a group of them had just come back from the Seaquarium because they had been taken on a field trip to get to see Miami Seaquarium, which I was very impressed. I didn't know that that degree of detail and of attention was given to these children. And then the Homestead facility was is for older children, adolescents, and I visited, saw where they slept. I asked, and I was told that they had laundry service. They didn't have to do their own laundry. They did their laundry for them.
Did you have full access in that one?
Full access. I visited classrooms where young children and young adults were learning English. I'm sorry, no, not young adults. Everyone's under the age of 18. I saw teenagers playing soccer outside. So it is possible that things have radically changed from my visit last year, but I can tell you that what I saw with my own eyes was a country and a facility that treats these refugee children who are victims with great care and compassion. Now, the child separation policy was unforgivable, inexcusable. That's wrong. That's a totally separate thing.
Okay.
And I unequivocally condemn that, and I did. And we got the administration to stop that policy just a few days after it had been announced last year. There are allegations of mistreatment, that some children are suffering psychologically. Those all need to be looked into. I cannot say that that's not the case. It is very possible. Those are allegations, and they must be investigated. But by and large, Lewis, and I always want to make this point, because the president's rhetoric is a major distraction, and it's horrible, and it gives people the wrong impression. This is a generous country, and American taxpayers invest a lot in caring for the children that show up at our U.S. at the Southwest border unaccompanied with no adults.
All right. Things may have changed from what you're saying, because you visited last summer. We recently spoke with a gentleman, J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda. He's an immigration attorney with UC Davis. He recently had access to the Homestead facility. This is what he told us on our show.
The food is subpar. They're indoors for 23 hours a day, and so they're talking about cutting recreational activities. So, you know, that those soccer goals or soccer balls, those are things that are they're during their hour a day outside are the things that bring joy to them and make the other 23 hours bearable.
He goes on and he describes what he saw. He said he had full access, but I mean, how do you see this playing out in the election? Because if images of children in a facility get out, and you know that it will, I mean, how do you think the American public, you're saying we're a generous country, but how do you think the American voter is going to react to that?
Well, I think the first thing that the government should do is, again, open up the facility to members of the media. This was done when the facility was first opened. Well, it was first opened under the Obama administration, then closed, and then reopened under the Trump administration. And when it was reopening, the government opened the facility to the media. They should do that again. That way we don't have to imagine these things. That way we don't have to take my word for it or anyone else's word for it. The public should be able to see and to know what happens in these facilities. Now, your point is that immigration is going to be a topic in the 2020 election, as it should be, because, again, it seems like the political system will fail at achieving that bipartisan, broad, comprehensive solution that we need for immigration. And of course, that includes smart investments in Central American countries where the option to stay and to prosper in those countries will actually exist for people.
I wanted to ask you about temporary protected status. So under the Trump administration, TPS has ended for numerous groups. It's ending soon, I should say, for numerous groups, Haitians, Hondurans, many others. There has been conversation about giving it to Venezuelans. But what do you think our responsibility is to any of these groups when we know many of these countries are not safe to go back to yet?
So our solution, and I filed legislation while I was in Congress, was to give permanent status to all of the individuals that are today under the TPS category. Now, what the Trump administration says, it's true. These are temporary programs. People should not be living under these programs for 15 and 20 years. Once people have been in our country that long, they should be afforded the opportunity to enter the legal immigration system and to become permanent residents.
We're not expecting them to have to return.
Of course not. If
we know their country's not safe.
Of course not. That would be ridiculous. And I do hope something else that I advocated for over the years, that Venezuelans are granted temporary protected status. They clearly need it. They clearly cannot return to Venezuela. 4 million people have, Venezuela has produced 4 million refugees. We can't expect that people will return. And there are many Venezuelans living illegally in our country, and they should be afforded an opportunity to get right with the law and probably to stay here, because I don't think anyone's going to be returning to Venezuela for a very long time.
How do you think the president should approach? I mean, he's, as you said, he's going to be relaunching his campaign in Florida, and Florida's an important state for him. But if he's removing TPS from Haitians, Hondurans, Nicaraguans, and if he hasn't given it to Venezuelans, I mean, that's a big part of the vote.
Yeah, the president in Florida is helping himself and hurting himself at the same time. We know that his foreign policy is popular with Cuban Americans, Venezuelan Americans, Nicaraguan Americans. So I think he's doing pretty well with those groups. There's a big Puerto Rican community in the central part of the state that he is clearly offended and upset. And of course, there are immigrants from many other countries that are turned off, as they should be, as I am, by his immigration rhetoric and by some of his actions when it comes to immigration policy. The bottom line is that this president, more than any other, had a great opportunity to solve immigration in our country. Because since he came in with all this immigration tough talk, he had the room to negotiate with Democrats and to reach a bipartisan solution. We tried to put that on the floor last year, and regrettably, it didn't pass. No Democrats voted for it, and about half of the Republicans voted against it. So we only got 121 votes. But that's the kind of solution that will allow us to kind of graduate from this immigration issue that we've been debating for about 15 years now, since George W. Bush first kind of asked Congress to make this a priority.
Coming back to children real quickly, is, you know, I wanted to also ask you about the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. This under the Obama administration, DACA, again, allowing people brought to the U.S. illegally as children to remain in the U.S. But do you think this is something that continues, or do we have to find a different approach to this issue?
So that was my greatest immigration priority while I was in Congress. As a matter of fact, in the 114th Congress, I was the only member of the House that filed a Dreamer bill. Democrats didn't even bother to file one that Congress because they didn't think it would pass. But I thought it was important for there to be a bill that would offer these young people a permanent solution, a pathway into the legal immigration system. I mean, these are the perfect kinds of immigrants. They're culturally competent. They grew up in our country. They speak the language. They know how to conduct business here, the kind of the American way of life. So, of course, they should be given not just, by the way, permanent status, but a path to citizenship, which is something that I insisted on for Dreamers because they are so obviously American to me. So this is another issue where the president did agree to a path to citizenship for Dreamers. He is on the record supporting that, but he hasn't pushed the issue enough to force Democrats to the table. And by the way, this requires both sides to cooperate. I remind people all the time, President Obama campaigned in 2008, said that during his first year in office, immigration would be solved. Democrats had 60 votes in the Senate, a wide majority in the House, and decided to do nothing. Regrettably, both parties or people in both parties like to use this issue to get their base excited, to get people to the polls, and then when it comes time to solve it, they say, no, let's leave it out there a little longer. That way we can use it for the next election. That's immoral, in my view. The president has certainly done it. Some Democrats have done it as well.
So we look again, coming up on 2020, and what you think South Florida voters are going to care about most. And again, this is what we're going to tackle, immigration and climate risk in our town halls. We don't know what's going to be asked of the candidates while they're here, but you know the issues most important to people here. What do you think are those top two or three issues the voters care most about?
Well, I congratulate you because you all chose two of the big ones. Certainly immigration and climate are top of mind for most South Floridians. I think transportation infrastructure is another one. That a lot of people in South Florida are frustrated with. Things have gotten better. We know that our roads have been built out, and we now have a commuter rail here in South Florida, which is exciting. But, of course, a lot of broken promises when it comes to public transit, and a lot of people disappointed about that. Another major issue, not just for South Florida, but I think for a lot of urban areas, is affordable housing and how to handle that. We know a lot of big cities are struggling with that. And the crisis here is certainly starting to become more and more acute. So I think those are some of the other big issues. And the economy is always a major issue in national elections. If the economy continues to grow steadily, I think that will probably help the president.
So we've seen again in 2016, Hillary Clinton did take Miami-Dade County. But Trump did eventually win Florida. And we look at 2018, there was a Democratic surge of sorts in a way. What do you think the Republicans have to do for 2020? Not just in the presidential race, but we're talking about other seats up and down, you know, from state to local. What changes next year?
Look, I think every Republican needs to show that this is a unique presidency, and this is a president that tests the limits of executive power more than any that I can remember. And certainly George W. Bush and Barack Obama were known for executive excesses. This is now in a league of its own. So I think Republicans need to show that, sure, of course, although they're Republicans and work with the administration on a lot of issues, that they're also willing to disagree with the president and to call him out when he's wrong. And we saw some Senate Republicans do that recently when the president mentioned that he would be willing to accept information from foreign sources on political opponents. That's just something completely out of bounds, misguided. And Republicans need to show that they take their Article I powers, those Republicans that aren't in Congress, that they take their Article I powers and responsibilities seriously.
So we've seen the president now press on Cuba, but, you know, again, we still have everything that's happening in Venezuela. How do you think that plays out? How do you think Venezuelans are going to feel next year if Maduro is still in power? And how are Cubans going to be voting as, again, he's putting more pressure now, again, on the Cuban government?
Well, I think there's no question that this administration has spent more political capital on Latin America, specifically with regards to these dictatorships, than perhaps any since the Reagan administration. And I think a lot of Cuban-American and Venezuelan-American and Nicaraguan-American voters are going to reward that no matter what happens in Venezuela. Now, certainly, the next few months are critical in Venezuela. Either Maduro continues to consolidate power or there's this kind of tie that we've seen that we've kind of lived under for the last few months. There is a possibility that not just Venezuelans in the country, which are the ones we're most concerned about, but also Venezuelans that have registered to vote in the United States get fatigue and lose some of their some hope and some motivation, and that could cost the president politically. But I think, generally speaking, for those voters that pay close attention to what's happening in Venezuela and Cuba and Nicaragua and Colombia and in other Latin American countries, they're appreciative of all of the capital that this administration has invested.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you about your political future. And, you know, look, different people have been saying different things, that maybe again another run for Congress or perhaps running locally. But what is Carlos Gabela preparing himself for?
Well, the most important thing I'm doing here in the short term is sharing my insights and my views with people like you. And of course, I collaborate with NBC News, MSNBC, and Telemundo. And that's been a lot of fun. But the truth is that I am considering running for office again in 2020. I get a lot of calls asking me to run for Congress again. It's something that I am definitely considering. But what most motivates me right now is the possibility of running for county mayor. I think this community could really benefit from a new generation of leadership. I think people in rising generations really deserve the chance, the opportunity to solve some of the big challenges that have remained unsolved here. And I'm thinking about transportation and infrastructure. A major promise was made to this community in one of the first elections that I was able to vote in, that we would expand Metro Rail and that it would go out to Kendall, where I live, and up north and down south to Homestead. And of course, we've seen none of that. We've seen billions of dollars squandered away. And that's something that, I think it's going to take a new generation of leaders to solve challenges like
not,
that.
Not a lot of names have jumped in just yet on the count of Miami-Dade County mayor race, but when do you think you would make that announcement if you were going to do it?
By the end of the summer. It's a big campaign. It's something you have to prepare for. You have to build out an agenda. You have to raise funds. So I think at the latest, by the end of the summer, I'll have a decision.
When you're ready to make that decision, you're welcome to come back, please, and we'll talk to you about it without a doubt. I also wanted to just extend the invitation. I know we have invited you. We are doing our town halls. You're invited to both if you'd like. We'd love to have you there. Again, we're going to be
tackling.
Thank you.
I don't know if I can make it, but I do commend the organization for putting those together because, those two issues are and should be top of mind for every South Floridian.
He is Carlos Gabela, again, former U.S. Representative for Florida's 26th Congressional District. Mr. Gabela, thank you so much for the
time. Thank you, Louis.
And again, I just want to remind everybody, as I just mentioned, that we are going to be doing those town halls. It is the 24th and 25th, Monday and Tuesday. It is a live event. Seating is limited, so if you're interested, go to WLRN.org and go ahead and make your reservation now. And again, we're going to be tackling immigration and then climate risk on Monday and Tuesday.